And it's time to welcome my guest this afternoon. It's Gordon Rushmer, and thank you for coming in, Gordon. Now, Gordon's been an artist, what, for over 50 years now?
Oh, well over 60-something years. A lifetime.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, you obviously do some beautiful paintings, landscapes and all of that, but you've done something very unusual, haven't you, as well? You've been a war artist.
I have. I was a war artist attached to Royal Marines and Special Forces, both Dutch and British, for 12 years, I think.
Well, how do you become a war artist?
Oh, you don't set out to be a war artist. You've got to be mad to do that. My life was painting, doing graphic design and painting landscapes, basically. And then in 1997, I had a phone call out of the blue, and it was a Royal Marine captain who'd forgotten to commission a painting for the Royal Marine Corps Christmas card, and he had 3 days to get a painting done. And he went through what was then Yellow Pages and found my name as the closest artist to Portsmouth.
Wow.
So he phoned me up and told me, you know, he'd got a problem, he'd got 3 days to produce a painting, and what could I do for him? And I'm always hungry, so I said, whatever you want me to paint, I'll paint it. So I knocked him out a painting in 3 days, and was paid for it, with notes in a brown envelope, and that was it, forgotten. And 2 weeks later, only 2 weeks later, I had a call from a colonel in the Dutch Marines who came on, and he said, My Royal Marine friends tell me you do anything for money. Will you come and talk to me? And wanted me to go across the Rotterdam for a day and have a chat, which I did. Got a flight across the Rotterdam. Chatted to this colonel who headed up Dutch Special Forces. And he simply said, look, we need an artist to go to Bosnia. We want a British artist to go into Bosnia and record what we're doing. And at that point, the Bosnian conflict was running down, really, but they were chasing war criminals and trying to pick up all the stray people. So I went over and recorded what they were doing. And the main part of the project, really, was I had to go to a village called Armici, in Bosnia, where there'd been a massacre of Muslims in 1993, and the Muslims had been through, or the Muslims lived there, sorry, and the Croat militia had been in and massacred about 120 Muslims over a 2-day period, and the Dutch Marines were in there looking for the people that had sort of committed all the atrocities, because they'd murdered people, they'd killed babies, killed cats and dogs, anything Muslim, they destroyed the mosques, the people, horrendous, burnt people alive, you name it. So I went in with the Dutch to sort of observe them picking up the pieces, really, and rounding up criminals and that sort of thing, you know. So that was my introduction to the military.
Now, I knew that we had war artists back in the World Wars. Mm. I was a bit surprised we still have them today. Is there something about a painting which will bring as more effect than a photo or a video?
Well, I think if you get the right artist, you'll get input, you'll get emotional input. If you take a civilian into a war zone, painter or not, it's going to affect you. And if you take a painter in, they're going to react. I mean, I reacted to the situations. I was totally green. I had no idea about the military, and I wasn't really prepared. I mean, I was just told to turn up and we'll take you in. So I had to go in with these guys and fend for myself, really, and survive, which was fine. I mean, they looked after me, but emotionally, I guess that takes a bit of coping with. But I handled it all right. It was no huge problem. The excitement carried me through, really.
Yeah.
Because you're with people, professionals, who do a job and know how to do a job really well.
Mm. So when you went with the British forces, did you have to do anything, any special training before you went?
What happened? I came back from Bosnia, and the Dutch Marines, the British Royal Marines Museum came on to me and wanted to know why I'd been working for the Dutch and not the British. And they introduced me to the Royal Marines, who then decided they could use me. But they took me away. First of all, they took me away on an exercise for a month to observe what they were doing in training, really. So I joined the Royal Marines, really, at the age of 58 or something. I mean, late middle age, I thought. And they issued me with a uniform and all the kit. And we went off to the Mediterranean, and then we invaded Turkey in landing craft and helicopters. And so I lived with the guys on the ground and went through all the different war scenarios, but with blank ammunition, which was perfect, because I could walk where I wanted and ask damn fool questions in difficult situations. So that schooled me, really, into the methods. And then I was ready to sort of, if they wanted me, I could move on to other things.
How did the soldiers react to you at first? Were they must have found it a bit unusual, should we say, to have an artist with them?
Well, yeah, incredulous, I guess, at times. But most of these guys, if they're told we've got an artist coming, look after him, then they just accommodate you and look after you. You know, there was never any problem at all. It was quite a novelty. And guys would volunteer to look after me because they get an easy ride. You know? So from that point of view, I was quite welcome.
But you say in the book you would muck in and try and help out where you could.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I learned very quickly to make the tea, make the brew. I mean, that endears you straight away, especially if everybody's busy and you're sitting around, you know, twiddling your thumbs, waiting for something to look at, something to photograph. And if you can make the tea, that's terrific. I mean, that's just what they want, you know. And then you become one of the crowd. And occasionally you get nervous, you get frightened, you know. I mean, if you're not used to war situations, loud bangs and that sort of thing tend to startle you a bit. And I was always the first one to swear. but then they realise you're human and you're just like them.
Yeah.
You know, because they don't... If you're too standoffish, you're not going to get access to what you want. But once you're in with the boys... and then you say, how does that work, or how does this work, or can you take me, you know, can you take me for a ride in that helicopter, or and then it's easy. They accommodate you quite readily.
Well, you earn their respect, really, don't you?
Yeah, yes, you do. I mean, I was treated as a professional in my own field, doing a job, you know.
You were living with them as well. You were, you know, roughing it.
Yes.
You know.
Wherever we were, I lived with them side by side, whether it was on the ground or in a tent or wherever. Ate the same food, experienced the same shortage of sleep, which is, if you're going to be a painter in that situation, it's vital. You need to... It's, you're not just painting a pretty picture, but you want the mood, you want to feel the whole thing, you know. It fascinated me to know what these young people put up with, what they go through in some of these situations. I mean, if you don't eat for 36 hours or there's no water, you know, you muck in, you help each other, you know.
Mm.
And I still miss that camaraderie.
Mm. Most of them are young enough to be your sons, weren't they?
Yeah, well, I think most of them are younger than my son, but so good at what they do.
Yeah.
I mean, so well trained.
Mm.
Um, I, And again, as I say, whatever I wanted, they'd show me, no problem, fire a mortar, shoot a rifle, yeah. You know. Trained from a very early, I mean, like Royal Marines, average age is 23, yeah. I think, you know. Yeah. Fine young people.
Yeah.
We should be proud of our forces.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Tell us about, you arrived on HMS Ocean, didn't you?
Yes. No longer with us.
No.
Scrapped. That was part of the trip to the Eastern Mediterranean. I was flown out to join HMS Ocean in Crete. So I joined, she was an assault ship then, carried landing craft and accommodated about 800 Royal Marines, I suppose, something like that. And she was used as a sort of assault base. So if you assaulted a beachhead, you'd go in fairly close and then fly in with helicopters or landing craft, you know. So it was like a headquarters ship, I suppose, for a Marine Corps. So we sailed from Heraklion right up to Saras Bay in Turkey, and then went through a whole landing scenario there. And that was quite interesting. I mean, I'd never lived on a warship. And because I was surplus to requirement, really, I mean, I had accommodation. I just about had a bunk that was probably 2 foot wide and 6 feet long, but no privacy. And I was up near the anchor locker, right up the front of the, right under the flight deck.
Pretty noisy spot.
Pretty noisy, yeah, yeah. So I on and off, I was on her for a month, I suppose. A fantastic experience again. And you're right in with the guys, you know, you're right cheek by jowl with everybody.
And you had your first helicopter ride.
Yeah.
What was that like?
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, I think my first trip was in a Gazelle, little tiny Hilo, and they just flew me around, and then they started putting me onto Chinooks, and we were doing landings, beach landings off Chinooks, and because I was having to live like a Marine, I mean, I was having to wear the face makeup, carry my own kit, Bergen, all the lot, you know, whatever I needed, I had to carry like the other guys, you know. But the first time we went in on a Chinook, we all loaded into the back, and I was being polite and was last up the ramp, and there was nowhere to sit, only on the floor. So I sat on the floor with my Bergen still on, and then I was strapped to the floor. And then when we hit the beach, all the other guys got off. And my Bergen was so heavy that I couldn't get up. I couldn't stand. And one of the guys saw me sort of, you know, rolling around like a turtle. One of the guys came on and grabbed my hand, pulled me up, and off we went, you know. And I discovered they do this all the time. They help each other. Anybody that's got a problem, somebody's there to, you know, help them out.
Yeah, I mean, that's what it's all about in the military, isn't it? You know, you're doing it for the rest of the team.
Yes, and you do... Yeah, you work as very close-knit groups, really, you know. I mean, I hear all this thing about you fight for queen and country or king and country, but you fight for each other, you know. You fight for your own little group, you know, because it's in a proper live situation, it's survival, you know. So you stick together, watch each other's backs.
Mm. In the book, you mentioned there was a sergeant major who stayed. He didn't speak to you, did he? He was very silent. No. Sergeant major.
Yeah. Well, civilians are always suspect in those situations. Yeah. Quite right too. And I obviously looked like a soft civilian, even if I had the uniform. He didn't. He watched me, really, and he obviously thought I would duck out after a day or two, you know, that I'd want to go home. And his attitude, if you like, it wasn't an aggressive attitude, he just ignored me, really, but I knew he was watching me. And that just made me dig in my heels, really. And I thought, well, you know, you're not going to beat me. I'm going to hang in for as long as it takes, really, you know. And eventually, he realised that, actually, right, so I can stick it. And then he talked to me and we were fine, you know. But I had to go through this this period when...
Again, you know, earning his respect.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Which is fine. I accepted it then, and I have no problem with that.
Mm. And tell us about the Arctic training. You went off with the Marines to do some Arctic training.
Yeah, they took me up to Norway. I had a couple of weeks in Norway with 4-2 Commando on winter Arctic training, because it was decided that I'd experienced sort of, if you like, temperate training, but that my education wouldn't be complete unless I'd gone somewhere and got very cold. So they flew me up to the Lofoten Islands, and I went out there and watched the guys snowshoeing and skiing, building bivouacs in the forest, snow holes, living in snow holes, whole different game. But now, vital. I mean, this last 2 or 3 years, Arctic training is the thing to be doing, you know. We have more of a threat now with the Russians coming around the top and in through the Arctic. So, vital. But Royal Marines have always been very good at Arctic training.
A little bit nippy out there.
Yeah, it was. There was a bit of frostbite. There was rain. There was freezing rain. Not much snow falling. Plenty of snow on the ground, but freezing rain, which is not good for frostbite. I was okay, but some of the guys who were living out in it had minor frostbite. But they get used to it. Yeah. You know, that's part of character building.
Tell us about the ice breaking drills that the Marines do.
The ice drills. Mm-hmm. Yeah, part of your training as a Royal Marine in the Arctic is you have to go through ice drills, because if you're going to walk across a frozen lake, you don't really know how thick the ice is. And on occasions, you fall through. And if you fall through, you need to know how to get out again. So as part of the training, they will cut like a small swimming pool in the ice, really. And the ice where I was probably, I don't know, 2 feet thick, probably. But they'll cut a swimming pool in there. And then the guys have to put skis on, And a white suit over their kit, and then a Bergen on their back, and then they ski into this icy pool, and they have to swim across it. It's not far; it's only, I don't know, 15 feet, 20 feet, something like that. But then they have to get out on the other side, and it's getting out again, out of the water and up onto the surface of the ice. That's quite difficult. So you have your ski poles. And you use the pointy end of the ski holes, and you claw your way out. Mm. Fortunately, I was too old to have the pleasure.
I was going to say, did you ever go?
No. But you get a tot of rum.
I was going to say the tot of rum to get the wet kit off, get the dry kit on.
Reaches the parts, as I say. Anyway, I was just a spectator. Thank goodness.
Was it then that you were in the Viking armoured vehicle, which went on its side?
Yeah, we had Vikings little tracked vehicles. It's a like a motor unit and a trailer, and they're both tracked. And we were going up a mountain road somewhere and swerved, and the thing rolled off the road, and we all tumbled round inside it, you know. And eventually climbed out through the sort of side door.
Well, you did go out with a rather tough bunch, aren't you? You know, with the
yes. Yeah, I couldn't have picked anybody much tougher, really, could I?
No, not really.
You know, but they're fantastic. I mean, I think they're the best. I mean, I'm a champion of the Royal Marines, really. Yeah, you know.
Definitely. How did you go about doing the paintings? Do you take photos first, or?
Yeah, I mean, in most of the situations, if it's peaceful, if you're not actually in a war-fighting situation, you might get the opportunity to sit and draw. But everything moves quite swiftly, so you generally... I mean, I had to work out right at the beginning, how am I going to handle this? Because nobody told me how to do the job, you know. So I thought, well, if I have a camera, that's a start, and I'll take a sketchbook as backup, really. But most of the time in the field, I was using a camera and memory, really. I mean, memory's very good for capturing mood. I can remember, you know, I can remember what places smell like, if you like. Mm-hmm. And there are situations where the smell and takes you back.
Oh, yeah.
And then makes the paint flow better, you know.
Yeah.
A lot's committed to memory, but detail I record with a camera or a sketchbook, but mostly with camera. Mm-hmm. And I'll take thousands of photographs. You just bang away because you never quite know. You know you're not going to pass that way again, and you want to get all the information in, whether it's weapons or uniforms or kit or the way people walk or whatever you come across. I recorded it just in case, because there's always a time when you think, how many laces has that boot got, or what was he actually wearing, you know. So it's quite hard work. I mean, you're at it every waking minute, really. Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
But that's the job. The job.
You must have quite a pile of sketchbooks, I imagine.
Yeah, I have. I have sketchbooks for every deployment. I think I did 10 or 11 deployments in all. So I've got sketchbooks and photographs for each deployment. That I can still dip into if I need them, you know.
Yeah. Now then, we won't go into too much detail, but at one point you're working with the Special Forces, aren't you?
Yep, Special Forces, yes. We don't talk too much about Special Forces, but they did take me into Afghanistan on one mission. I felt the safest I've ever been with these guys. Flew me in with no passport. My instructions, actually, my briefing before I went was don't bring a passport, don't have any name tags in your kit, so no identification at all. So I went in, well, I suppose ostensibly undercover. I'm never quite sure why that should be, but I suppose if you're picked up by the wrong people.
Yeah. I mean, you do say in the book that the guys, say we're not going to go into detail about the Special Forces, but they're very unassuming, aren't they? They don't make a big deal about what they do.
No. I mean, they're so ordinary to visually. you can't pick out a Special Forces guy from an ordinary guy, you know. They're mostly very quiet, unassuming, polite, don't take the bait when other people are taking the mickey out of them, you know. Very controlled, delightful. I mean, I never had a problem with anybody in Special Forces at all.
You're just saying about not taking your passport and taking name tags out and things like that. Did you ever think about what might happen if you did get captured?
Nope.
No, never occurred to you?
No. Well, no, it's a bit like flying in Chinooks. You don't think what's going to happen if you get hit or you crash. I mean, it's not important.
You're doing something that most people never do, and we were just saying while the record was playing there, you mean you're witnessing history and you're recording history with your paintings, aren't you?
Yeah. I mean, quite early on, probably by the second or third deployment, I realised that I wasn't just for me, for the client, for the regiment. Maybe I was just producing a painting. But as a member of the general public, as a painter, I took on the role of reporter as well as painter, because you see things that you want to tell people. You want to tell people what's happening, the hardships that you see, the suffering that you civilians suffering. In some countries, it's appalling. No water, no food, and we need to. The more people that report it, the better. Yeah. Really.
Mm, absolutely. And tell us about how you were in a Hercules of the Special Forces, Hercules C-1, and you asked the pilot, how high are we flying? I thought the answer he gave you was brilliant.
C-130, yeah. I was flown up from Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan up to Mazar-e-Sharif in the north of Afghanistan. And I had a Hercules almost as a taxi, really. It was for me and a couple of escorts, and we flew up. And I was sent up. I was sent up with the crew on the flight deck, which is on a Hercules. It's very small. There's not much room. I think there are three seats. Nowhere for me to sit. So I just climbed up into the cockpit. And the boss said, well, just stand there. And when I take off, hold on to the back of my seat, which we did. And we flew up over the Hindu Kush. And as we came down the sort of the north side of the Hindu Kush, you're on very high desert as you approach Mazar-e-Sharif, and there are, you can see the telegraph poles going by, you know, we're very, very low. And I did, it was a silly question, I asked the pilot how high off the ground we were, and he said if you can see the legs of the camels, we're at 100 feet. But if you can see the legs of the sheep, we're at 50 feet. You know, and it was like Biggles. It was. We weren't quite that low, but I mean that sort of you know, jokey. And the sweat was pouring off them. You know. And the other thing was there was a bucket in the corner, and if you need to spend a penny, well, that's the loo, that's the bucket. You know, there's nothing else.
Well, so. Some of the places where you're staying, that sounds like luxury compared to some of the conveniences.
Oh, yes. Well, the inconveniences, yeah. Yeah, they weren't... mostly it was a hole in the ground, really.
Yeah.
Well, that's okay. That's part and parcel.
Well, again, you're going through what the Marines are going through.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah.
But no, there's no special treatment because you're a civilian, is there?
No. No. I had a lovely lady once say to me, do they put you up in nice hotels?
Yeah.
No.
And you were literally living out of your Bergen, weren't you?
Oh, yes.
You know, there's no room. I mean, everything had to go back in and come, you know, there was nowhere to store anything. You had to carry it with you all the time.
Yeah. I mean, all right, if you're in a base, you know, you can get rations and food. But if you're out and about, you have rations, you have combat rations, basically, like boil in the bag. You have your own little stove, your own individual stove that you can heat up water on. And you have bags of, you know, breakfast is beans and sausages, I think, and then there's butterscotch pudding and another bag. And so if you need hot food, you heat it up yourself and eat it straight out of the bag. Which I loved. I absolutely loved it. I mean, I was in the Boy Scouts, and it's a bit like being in the Boy Scouts, but with live ammunition.
Yeah, I mean, it's safe with guns. Yeah. You get your shooting badge.
Yes, yes. I found the whole mostly very exciting.
Yeah, yeah. Well, absolutely.
And a huge pleasure. I mean, what an honour.
And, I mean, obviously you enjoyed it because you kept on going back for more, didn't you?
Yeah. I found it addictive, probably because I was being looked after. I mean, I always had an escort, which does make a difference. Therefore, I didn't ever get into any real tight squeezes because there was always somebody to guide me. But it is addictive. I found it just being with what I called real people doing a real job, you know, fine young people, well trained, could take decisions. I mean, young men, in 1920 who were taking life and death decisions. Amazing to be with people like that, so well trained, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And then you spent some time with logistics, didn't you? Tell us about
Yeah, Royal Marines logistics. Yeah. Yes, I went into Afghanistan. That would have been my second deployment to Afghanistan. And I went in with Royal Marines logs. Yeah. And that really was to study how the logistics regiment, or military logistics generally, really, how it works. Because you can't fight wars without support. You've got to have ammunition shipped up, with water rations, vehicles, fuel. You can't fight without all this support. You know, I mean, there are so many cases in history where generals have extended their lines of communication too far and can't be resupplied. You know, so I had time there traveling. Traveling in convoys, really, shipping vehicles or fuel, and that again, it is something you don't. It's not glamorous, but it has to be done.
Yeah.
And nobody works without the right kit. You know, yeah.
And
yeah.
You did a mind awareness course.
Yeah, I did. Yes, that was. Yes, that was the first time anybody thought that I ought to learn about mines. Nobody thought about that before, you know. So I did a mine awareness course. Well, it's a lecture, really. I mean, basically, they show you all the horrible things that can happen to you if you tread on a mine, or anti-personnel mine, or whatever. Where not to walk. Always be aware, always be very streetwise. And if there's an area where you think there might be mines, then you stick to hard surfaces. Don't go wandering off, which I did do once and got away with it. But it concentrates the mind, basically, and it's very important. I mean, for people like somebody like me, you know, because I get so excited about getting a great view on something that I'll wander off into the desert, you know, walk off the tarmac and wander across the sand, you know, and there are some places that are littered with mines,
yeah.
You know, in many countries.
Yeah. And you get an RSM shouting at you to get back on the road, or
With one or two expletives built in as well. But there was only one time when I, you know, was a bit silly and wandered off. But not far, but far enough, you know. And the question was just asked, can you find your way back? You know, of course, you just have to, if you tread in your footsteps in the sand, footprints, you're fine, you know. But it's a salutary lesson, and you don't reckon to make the same mistake twice, you know.
Yeah. Tell us about the time when you were actually, they thought it might be an idea to give you a pistol. What, an officer or somebody gave you a pistol?
Yeah, well, that's highly illegal.
Oh, well, you better not mention that, then.
No, I did. I think there were four of us somewhere overnight in a bivvy. And I thought it would be quite... there were three guys and me, and they were doing like a standing guard one at a time through the night. And I said, well, look, if I do it as well, if I'm one of the, you know, make it four and I'll do my bit, that means you can all get a bit more sleep. And it was fine. I was given an SA-80 rifle and just stood there in the dark. Nothing happened. It was fine. It was absolutely fine. We were safe. But, I mean...
Unlike the time when you were with a unit, and you got into a firefight, and a corporal came along. I think he said it in the book. It says, "Watch this gourd, make us a great painting."
Yeah, that's a great pal of mine now. You shall be remain nameless, but I just met this Royal Marine I think he was a corporal then.
Yeah.
He pitched up. I was observing, if you like. I was observing a column going along the Helmand River, pushing or being attacked by Taliban, actually. So there's lots of machine gun fire and automatic fire and stuff, and I was on a hill with guys sort of watching what was going on, sort of 500 meters away, I suppose. Anyway, this Royal Marine pitched up in his armoured Land Rover and said, you're the war artist, aren't you, Gord? You know, come on, you know, let's show you what we can do, you know. And he had a shoulder-mounted sort of launcher, I don't know, missile launcher, yeah. I suppose you'd call it. And he demonstrated the damage that you could do with a missile launcher.
And which he, was he wanted you to record it in paints as well.
Yes, I did. Yeah. I mean, that again was quite a salutary lesson in the right weapon in the right hands, the damage it can do, you know, like it or not.
Yeah. With all of what you experienced and what you witnessed, did it change your outlook on life at all?
Yeah. Greatly, I think. Yes. I'm probably not dramatically, but I am still aware, because I won't change again now. I became far more tolerant of certain things and far less tolerant of other things. I don't want to get into politics, but I can't abide politicians at all anymore. Decision making worries me now. Political decision making.
Well, I think what you say in the book is that the politicians decide these things, but they're not necessarily making sure the guys that are going to go out there have got the right kit. And
Oh, Lord, no. I mean, I think it would appear that we're always pushing. There's an instant decision, you know, and well, next week we want these guys to go, you know, without any, without the right kit to start with. I'm sure we went into Afghanistan, first of all, without the right kit. I mean, it doesn't make much difference. I mean, like, people like Paras and Royal Marines are so tough and well trained. Doesn't matter whether they got the wrong boots or not. Mm. Right boots, wrong boots. They're still going to do the job. But if they've got the right kit, it does make the job that bit more bearable, I suppose, you know. But if you're going to throw people in without enough body armour or without weapons that don't always work, the jam when they get too hot or are not dustproof, for instance, that's pretty shocking, you know. But that's history. I mean, that's right through history. Armies have never been probably equipped the way you'd like them to be equipped, and it takes governments and manufacturers years to catch up, really, before they've managed to supply people with the right kit, you know. I mean, one of my trips to Afghanistan, they said they would give me body armour, and my body armour for the flight over, my body armour was a sort of very flimsy jerkin with one ceramic plate over my heart, and it was a ceramic plate about 9 inches square, I suppose. And I did think, well, that might be okay, but what happens if I get hit somewhere else? But a shortage of kit, you know. But I always accepted that and didn't really bother me that much. It's, if you take on the job, you know, I figured you just take on the job and do it.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely. Now, are you still painting? I bet you are. You still want to use landscapes and...
Yeah, it's always been an obsession. I'm afraid. I mean, it's been my life. Mm. I always wanted to paint since I was at art school. And little by little, I've managed to... I went to art school and I trained as a graphic designer and book illustrator because I knew I'd have to earn a living, and I could earn a living doing graphics, which I did. But I always wanted to be a painter and sell paintings. So little by little, I built up the painting side. And at some point, I sort of became a painter. That's what sounds grand to call yourself a painter. Mm. I paint pictures and sell them.
Very, very nice pictures. Yeah. You've done a few round here as well. You have the Portland Bill and places like
yes,
that.
Yes, I have. Yeah. I mean, we come to Dorset quite a lot. I've always come to Dorset, but this last few years, I've come to Dorset more and more. And then discovered Athelhampton. Mm-hmm. I know you're going to get onto Athelhampton. And Athelhampton have given me a show. I'm preempting what you want to say, really. Athelhampton offered me an exhibition, which gave me a jolly good reason to spend more time in Dorset and paint Dorset landscape, but also paint Athelhampton House, which is, I suppose, been my prime sort of occupation for a year and a half, I guess, now. Wonderful.
I should say the exhibition's on at the moment, isn't it?
It is open today.
And it's open till March of next year, I think so.
It's a six-month exhibition.
Yeah, well, the wife and myself will be going along to have a look at that.
Good.
Yes.
Take a checkbook. Oh, it's not checkbook anymore, is it?
No. You're as bad as me, a checkbook.
Credit card.
You'll be talking about that funny stuff called cash next.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So pop along to Athelhampton House. It's going to be great. How many pictures have you got?
60.
I thought it was about 60.
Yeah.
I would like to say you've got some of your pictures being displayed in all sorts of interesting places. The House of Lords.
Yeah, I've got... I think I've got four or five in their collection.
Yeah, wow.
Imperial War Museum have got, I don't know, probably 15 pieces, I think, stored away. You've got more detail.
Foreign and Commonwealth Office?
Yes, they've got some.
And the Royal Archive?
Yeah, I used to do birthday cards for Her Majesty the Queen.
Wow.
That were commissioned by a lady-in-waiting, and some of those went into the Royal Collection. Yeah, which was lovely. Nice little, you know, Christmas, not birthday cards.
Yeah.
But all of the, I don't know, I painted ships for the Queen, HMS, I don't know, Prince of Wales or whatever, you know. And she used to have them put into the Royal Archive, which was wonderful. I mean, it's a great honour, that, you know.
Well, you've done some amazing, amazing paintings. You're very, very talented, obviously. And you're known internationally as well, aren't you?
Well, yeah.
You're too modest. I'm building you up now, Gordon, you know. excellent. But it's been brilliant having you in today. It's a fascinating career.
Well, thank you for having me.
And it's been brilliant. And just remind everybody that you can go and see Gordon's paintings at Athelhampton House anytime between now and next March. And like I say, we'll be going along. And if you remember what the checkbook is about, then take that with you. Thank you very much, Gordon. Cheers.
A pleasure.